AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence.
This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy, me, episode 63 for July 15th, 2010. 5 kilowatts in a suitcase. Peter DeLorenzo, who's normally here with us, is not here tonight. He's out traveling. We wish you're here. I hope you're watching, Peter. We want you back. David Welch should be joining us. I know David had a busy night tonight, but we've got Jim Hall here with us right now. Say a few words so they believe me.
I am Jim Hall. Actually, no, I'm Bob Hall in disguise. I've lost weight.
And later in the show, after we get through some of the news here, we're going to have Professor Peter Hofbauer. And this is why, for those of you who are watching right now, why we have an engine on the table in front of us. And we'll be explaining what that's all about. And
a fuel cell.
And well, it's not a fuel cell,
is
but it's power
cell,
like one.
Power cell.
But we'll be bringing Peter Hofbauer on in a little bit while, a little while from now. But let's get to the news, Jim. Some interesting things going on.
Woo!
Did you see the changes at Ford?
I saw the changes at Ford that look like they're precipitated by the imminent departure of Volvo from technically under the wing of Mother Ford. I mean, it looks like that's what the whole thing is. And I saw that the Geely Lord Dukakis guy is now going to be in charge of Volvo. And it's all changed. It was to be expected. I mean, it's new ownership. But in a lot of times when sales like this happens, you kind of position the people beforehand. And that's what surprised me.
Mm-hmm.
I really thought that the crew that was on deck at the company was going to be the crew that was going to go over there. So it was a bit of a surprise.
Yeah, a lot of changes that I find very interesting. Steve Adell, who had been running Volvo,
right,
now going to take over as CEO and chairman of Ford of Europe.
But that's logical. You know, they don't have to move him that far.
I'm sure they're not looking to save money on plane fares, putting him in charge.
Yeah.
But what I find interesting, John Fleming, the guy who held that position,
right,
coming here to the States to run manufacturing and labor. What do you read into that?
I see part of that is the whole idea of Ford trying to cross-globalize itself. Now that it's focusing on the Blue Oval, it's finding people with the strengths that they need for the jobs, and if they're not in the right part of the world, move them. And I really think that that's a lot of it, because you have to understand, if you look at Ford's European product mix, it is a product mix that is becoming, it's expensive. It's expensive by our standards, not by European standards. But they have to do those cars to make sure they're profitable, because Ford cannot afford to hemorrhage cash in Europe the way it used to and the way so on. So basically, he did a pretty good job of just sort of getting it lined up and, most importantly, setting Ford up for the global platforms they're using. A lot of which the cost engineering has been done in the most price-sensitive market. And you can imagine in a lot of cases that's not Europe.
Mm-hmm.
So I see that very logical. Bring them over here because, it's manufacturing. They have got to get their hand on manufacturing and make sure that they know exactly what it costs to build each car in each country and manage it. You guys are smart there.
And they gave them labor relations, which I find very interesting.
Usually it's tied to plants, though. Mm. You know, let's face it.
True. Yeah, right.
So if you look at it that way, it's like Gary Kauger at General Motors was manufacturing, and he was the guy that would deal with the bargain.
UAW.
Because, you know, the real interface, yes, there are UAW workers at the General Motors Tech Center doing stuff that doesn't seem to be assembly stuff. But the real interface for the company is at manufacturing, because that's where you're using the UAW guys, the union represented guys, to build the cars. So to me, I didn't find that that anomalous. Mm-hmm. I really didn't.
Well, I find it interesting in that you're bringing a European in to deal with the UAW.
That's the issue.
That's the issue.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, he's going to have staff that have been dealing with the union all along, so it's not like it's a totally clean break. But I also wonder, is Ford looking at this guy? I mean, he's run all of Ford of Europe, right? Alan Mulally, everybody's wondering, when's he going to go? Lewis Booth, who would be maybe the natural to step in, is not that much younger than Alan.
Exactly.
And so could John Fleming from Europe be put in place that in case this guy could be the next CEO of Ford?
I suppose.
I'm just asking.
It's possible, yeah. And there'd be the thing about grooming him for North America dealing with the UAW. But the truth is they could just as easily pick someone we don't even know. That's mm-hmm. what they did with Mr. Mulally.
Right. But that was unusual, and I don't see them going outside the next time
Stop
around.
Stop and think about it. It worked once, and it worked well. Okay?
It did.
Because it is about—
But they really lucked out getting Mulally.
I'm not sure it was luck. I think
How many Alan Mulallys are out there?
Oh, that's the issue.
That's what I mean
but
by luck.
But my point is that there are a lot of incredibly talented people out there
mm-hmm.
that could do it. They have to just make sure. See, more important than whether it is Fleming or not is they've got to make sure it's the right guy.
Yeah, absolutely
period.
Right.
The right guy. And with Mullally, I think they realized before Mr. Mullally was in, they didn't have the right guy in-house ready for that job.
Right.
So it's like, let's do it.
Right.
And if for some reason, why, it's Welsh.
It's David Welsh.
David Welsh.
We knew you'd be here.
I wanted to wait till the rain starts.
Well, that was a brilliant idea. I don't know if you know it, that this concerned me, and I talked to John about it, but, you know, using the telephone in a thunderstorm is bad. And I suspect the internet could be bad, too, but John says it's not, so I feel perfectly safe.
Well, I told him, since we're on the internet now and I need him as a guest to the end of the show, it's perfectly safe.
All right.
But we could get hit by a tornado here. So everybody watching or listening, if all of a sudden it goes dead.
It went through?
Okay.
That's why I was held up. I was literally walking out of the office at about 25 after. And I haven't seen storms like that since I lived in Texas.
It come down heavy, didn't it?
I mean, but it was real. I mean, it was sideways rain with major wind.
Before I landed here, and it was because of the storms. And then finally got in, and I was just about thinking, I may not make it.
Jim literally landed and ran up here to
Yeah, I was supposed to be in like at 4, and because of the weather there and intermediate, we were like circling. And
I mean, I could see it's getting dark, right? So I turn around, answer a few emails. I mean, we're on the 15th floor of the old American Motors headquarters. I turn around, and the sky looks like it's about 10 o'clock
stars.
At night.
Yeah, with no stars.
Yeah. And I said, oh, boy, I better get down the road. And I just, it didn't just look like a storm. It looked awful. I'm in the elevator going down. These aren't the fastest elevators, but still, I get down to the bottom.
They're sort of AMC elevators, right? Like Nash's.
Yeah. It was a Rambler elevator. I get down to the bottom floor, and it is just, I mean, the storm had started in the seconds it took me to get down, and it was just incredible.
Wow.
It was an interesting spectacle, but you couldn't. There was a bunch of people in the lobby. We just had to sit there and wait.
Yeah.
We were talking about the Ford stuff, you know, all change at Ford.
Yeah. Okay.
And what were you saying?
Well, with Mr. Mullally, it was pretty obvious they didn't have anybody internally and they went outside. And when it's time for the next guy to sit in that seat, I wouldn't be surprised if they don't think they've got a guy in line to do it, if they really don't believe it. And they, of course, means probably Mullally and the family.
Yeah.
And if that's what they believe, they'll go outside again because it has worked. It's just a question of making sure you got the guy that has the right attitude.
But see, my question was, they're moving John Fleming from Ford of Europe. The guy's been mm-hmm. CEO and chairman of Ford Europe, now coming here to do manufacturing right. and labor relations. Is he being put in place on the chance that Alan Mullally leaves in the next year or two? We were talking about Lewis Booth is probably the next logical guy mm-hmm. in line, mm-hmm. but he's not that much younger than Alan,
yeah.
right? So right. could they be bringing right. John Fleming over here that, just in case, boom, this guy steps right into the picture?
Let me ask you a question, though, John. Who was the last chairman or boss of Ford of Europe to run the company?
That's a good question. Probably Phil Caldwell.
I was going to say it was Caldwell. Caldwell would have been my guess too.
No, Jim's got another answer for us.
Wasn't Jack once president?
Did Jack run Europe? Okay, you could be right.
And what about Mr. Trotman?
I'm sure Trotman did too. Right.
Those didn't work out very well.
Yeah, but I don't think you can read.
I know. I'm just
right.
But it's if you start looking at repeating, that's all I'm uh-huh. saying. You've got to realize it's a situational decision you make when you basically get yourself, you know, a new CEO. It's in the situation you're in at the time. Now, I have no doubt that when Mr. Mullally leaves Ford, it's going to be a far different, far healthier Ford than when he got there.
Mm.
Far healthier.
Already is.
Well, exactly. And so the question is, what do you need then? What do you want to do with Ford? Do you want to build it? Do you want to basically make it astonishingly profitable and have a nice, comfy place to sit if you're the family? Or do you want to try to become number one, which is fraught with all manner of problems?
I don't think they will.
I don't either, but I'm just saying it's one of those philosophical issues. And remember that success is a drug.
You know, I was talking to Mark Fields about this. He actually, when he talks to the America staff, he was telling me, he always reminds them of how stupid they got in the late 90s when they were minting money on SUVs. And they got arrogant, they got distracted by, you know, all kinds of other ideas. And a lot of that was Nasser's strategy, but the whole company got arrogant, they got complacent, and they got distracted. And he reminds people of that constantly. You know, Fields is a guy who I thought maybe had an outside shot of.
I think he's got a good shot at it.
He still may.
But he's still may, but.
But he's young. The guy's what, 48? So, I mean, you could have two generations of management,
right,
or certainly another generation before they say, Mark, it's yours.
What's the total universe here of
Well, I'm looking at, Mullally goes, right? Next guy in line is Lewis Booth. He's got the chops. The guy can step in and run it.
2-3 years apart in age. So
right. You know. And then you've got John Fleming coming over from Europe. He's 58. Then you've got Steve O'Dell, who's now going to run Europe. He's 55. And then it drops down age-wise to people like Mark Fields. And then, and here's the next guy we've got to talk about, Jim Farley. What do you guys make of the changes with Jim?
People in Ford have told me that he's not a guy who would run the company.
Well, what I found interesting...
He's not broad enough, and he's...
They expanded his role in marketing, gave him not just marketing, but sales and service. And nobody's ever done that for Ford before.
Right.
On the other hand... He did have operations. They had given him Latin America, Mexico, and Canada to run, and now that's being taken away. So, sure, they're expanding his role on one area, but they're taking it away from another, and I'm just wondering.
That may be standardized work philosophy. If you think about it, the issues around sales, around marketing, are related directly to sales and to service because service supports sales, and if you do service right, it becomes a sales function for a dealer. Okay, he's selling sales, service. That's all sort of one task description, I mean, at a very broad level. Operations of foreign units is different yet again. And you might want to simply integrate your foreign operating people. So in a way, it's what General Motors has done. If you think about it, General Motors usually focused on an operational level around the world, and then the sales and marketing was separate from that. So it may be just rationalizing basically work task.
Farley's a good marketing guy. But I don't see him running the company. I mean, he did have Latin American responsibility, but things could change. But from what I've been hearing, his name doesn't get mentioned as a guy who's in that succession line.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. And maybe that's why they expanded his role and said, okay, you know, here's a new path to go after.
I've been saying this for almost 10 years, but the truth is this is the decade, this is the marketing decade for the auto industry.
Right.
Lots of competition in segments, lots of nameplates. Marketing is going to make or break a car. You could have an absolutely mediocre car in a segment. You market the dickens out of it smartly where you need to position it. You will outsell a great car that's poorly marketed.
Yeah. No, that's a good point. So why not, as you call it, the decade of marketing, why not have your marketing guy strictly focused
focus on that.
Just that?
I mean, because if you look at what's happened with Ford marketing, I mean, remember the vehicles that were brought up before Mr. Farley got here? And their launches. You remember the national launch campaign for the 500 and the Freestyle?
Mm-hmm.
How can you? There wasn't one.
Well, I was going to say, I remember it perfectly because there was nothing there.
And do you remember the launch for the Edge?
No.
The car driving on the parapet of the building?
So
many of them.
Right.
It's like Farley gets there and suddenly it's about message, product, and making sure the car is visible in the commercials.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, think of it. Where's the Ford commercial where you haven't seen the product? Other than the underlit Flex, which was grossly underlit. But, you know, the focus or the Fusion commercials I thought were brilliant. One significant idea in every commercial very graphically presented with a car driving around.
Right.
You know, you didn't even have to hear the sound to know what the message was.
Yeah, right. They're doing that with the F-150 now.
Exactly. And the rant commercials with Leary are brilliant.
Yeah.
They really are.
Even
people I know that don't like Dennis Leary love the commercials. I mean, he's got the tone that fits the product. So, to me, I mean, that's not all... That's not all, Jim, but a lot of that is that's Farley. You know, it's about the product, the message.
It doesn't mean he's a guy to be the CEO.
But I agree.
Because, and here's the thing. You know what happens in this business a lot? I mean, you see that at a micro level, like, say, within design at a lot of companies where someone's a good designer, so they put him into management.
Yeah, well, that's right.
And frankly, we have this problem in journalism where someone's either a good writer or a good reporter, so they make them an editor because they, as a good reporter, can ask their reporters the right questions or they can rewrite stuff and make it read well. But whether or not they are a good manager is purely incidental.
You see, in design, it's more lethal.
I know.
But
that's why I brought that example.
It's more lethal because in design, you take a guy that's a great designer, and you turn him into a manager and a design manager, and he's not designing anymore.
Right.
He becomes sort of a hypercritic. And you look at design at every major company. It's predominantly the big three, but it's really big companies. And it's what happens when the guy in design gets promoted. And you go back and look at the guy's work, and the guys do a lot of really interesting cars. They're great. They put him in management, and he stops designing. He has to design through surrogate by looking at stuff that's submitted and saying, do this, do that. And you've lost the individual's greatest strength. It's gone.
Yeah, and you know, you could have somebody like Farley who, he's good at marketing. And then if you elevate him up into management, he does less of that, and you better find somebody else who's good at that to do it. Instead, and forget about Farley for a second, if someone who's good at what they do and your way of rewarding them is just promoting them into management, why not just pay them more, give them stock options, and also listen to them about other issues within the company, but it doesn't mean they have to run everything.
No, that's exactly right. And that was a big issue here in town in the 80s, the care and feeding of your technical staff.
Exactly.
So when you have a guy who is a brilliant engine designer, we're going to get him, one of them in here very shortly, you want him to keep on doing that, or her.
Yes, exactly.
So you need to create a whole career path.
And General Motors.
To your point, and it's not just money. It's not just money. It's got to be perks and, you know, prestige and a whole bunch of other things so that they don't feel they have to get on the management track to really feel fulfilled in their career, that you want them to be fulfilled in what they're the best at.
General Motors created a category for that in their hierarchy and their levels of employees. It was called a 9 technical. And they would encourage these people and do things to get them published and so on. Mm-hmm. And they were remunerated with money and a lot of the stuff that the execs got, but not all of it because it still was a boys' club. And the last thing you want are some boffins in there, you know, that don't understand. You have to eat the pudding Roger Smith gets you because then you get smarter and you know that Roger's ideas are the greatest in the world.
Hey, let's get on to one other topic,
because
I had a number of other hears, but story broke this week. I think the Journal broke it of NHTSA doing all these studies on Toyota and finding that this unintended acceleration is not an electronics problem. So far, all the black boxes show that when people claim they had their foot on the brake, they did not. And when they claim they did not have it on the gas, in fact, the throttle was wide open.
Stop and think about it. Large incidents of these were in Camrys.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's another car in the Toyota range that uses the Camry powertrain. Well, it's sort of in the Toyota range.
Sienna?
No.
Avalon.
That had zero incidents of unintended acceleration.
Which was which?
The Scion TC. Now, let's just think about the buyers for a moment, okay? Not some doddering old boomer like me. But somebody that's younger and is probably...
I do worry when you're driving.
Oh, everyone does. Especially when I came into the parking lot sideways. By the way, I have experienced firsthand the Toyota brake override system. It is brilliant because it is totally natural feeling.
Now.
It feels absolutely natural. Mm-hmm. So they've got a fix for something that was basically a fix that should have gone to people's driving education. But that's not going to happen. You know, in the United States, as you know, we are entitled to, it says so somewhere in the Constitution, we're entitled to $1.90 a gallon unleaded gasoline and a driver's license. Okay, it's a birthright. That won't change. So we're going to see more and more of this stuff. But, what's the surprise? The hitting the nail analogy, you're driving a nail if you ever hit your thumb, okay?
Yep.
Well, that's 100% of your eye-hand coordination being put to the task of not hitting your finger or thumb, and you still hit it.
And you still do it.
And in a car, you've got eye-hand coordination, eye-foot coordination, hand-foot coordination without the eyes intervening, and you're doing this in a dynamic environment where things are moving and things are flashing and shiny stuff's going by.
And by the way, millions of people are doing this.
Exactly. So it was,
of course they make mistakes.
Of course.
You know. And
why does Toyota have a higher rate of mistakes than the others do? I mean, there's got to be something about
well, there's a couple
the
of
feel
things.
Of it, or
you
got to
look at the history of it. And if you look over the last decade, Toyota, the peak, and I mean the spike, I should say, in reported incidents came after this pedal entrapment story that broke. Horrific story. The cop down in the San Diego area.
Howard Patrolman.
Got killed with members of his family. Well, we know that was pedal entrapment. The floor mat got trapped.
And the driver's inability to put the car in neutral or to figure out how to turn the switch, the engine off.
Correct. But what I'm saying is, from that point on, the reported incidences just skyrocketed. Now, I will say this other thing, because it happened to me earlier this winter when I was on a Thursday night, ran out to go skiing early, cross-country skiing, and I came back and I still had my ski boots on. As I whipped into the parking lot here, the engine surged and the car went forward a little bit, and I went, what the hell is going on? Well, when I looked down at my feet, it looked at first like I had my foot on the brake, but because my ski boots are wider, I'm hitting the brake and the pedal at the same time.
Yep, and you're setting up an oscillation when you do that as the car moves.
Well, then the other thing is, I literally, on all our test cars, I got a tape measure out, and I started to measure the distance between the gas pedal and the brake, mm-hmm. you know, and the difference
the depth,
in
yeah.
the plane,
yep.
the depth. And Toyota's pedals are closer. Not all of them, not all models. It depends, mm-hmm. and it depends on other car companies, too. But the point, in fact, is that all brands, not just Toyota, have problems with unintended acceleration.
Sure.
And it's also very interesting that it does not happen at all, ever, with manual transmission cars.
Gee whiz.
And it only seems to happen in the United States. But to your point earlier, and this is documented, and nobody likes to hear it, it is older drivers, and this is especially what they don't like to hear. It's predominantly older women. Mm-hmm. And so them's the facts. That's all I'm going to say.
You look at the incidences. And
right. So I've said all along, we're the exact same arguments that we're hearing now of why it is a Toyota problem were the exact same arguments that were made against Audi yep. 25 years ago. Oh, there's something under the hood. Oh, they can't figure it out.
And they did have a problem with the floor mats, and they did find corrosion on those pedals.
Yeah, they did. But now
that wouldn't have accounted for unintended acceleration. It caused a sticky throttle that would just sort of bind a little bit. It returned, but it was sticky.
And the
floor mat thing, you have to understand, the floor mat thing, you know, you see a lot of the enthusiast magazines and then these giant ads for the really cool, they have floor mats, winter floor mats that will take an entire winter's worth of snow off your shoes and you dump them out in the spring. I mean, the things are getting big and bulky. It was only a matter of time that this was going to happen, and the question was, who was it going to be? Toyota has a lot of more vehicles. I mean, it was a thing a dealer put in to protect the carpeting. Mm-hmm. But the truth is, the entrapment with these big, giant winter mats was going to happen to somebody. I think a result of this, I don't think you're going to find car washes. If you take your car to a car wash where they pull the mats out, I think you may not find them taking mats out of cars anymore.
Yeah, because they might be liable after
exactly.
that.
Exactly. Because, you know, mats when they're properly installed and they're using the retention systems that the manufacturers pretty much all have in there, there's nothing wrong with a floor mat. Now you start stacking them up and collecting them like you know, trading cards for baseball or something, you have a problem. And when you put a mat in and you don't retain it, you get another problem. You know, you're driving, it's creeping or whatever.
Right. Your question still stands, why is Toyota having a higher incident? And somebody's got to do a good statistical analysis over a decade's time and compare it brand by brand and sales weighted, too.
Yeah, because remember, Toyota, these are cars they sold a lot of. High incidents in Camry. And it's only been the best-selling car in the United States for how long, you know?
Yeah, for as long as I can remember.
It's right like now. When you used to see that the most stolen car was the Cutlass Supreme Coupe.
There was a reason. Yeah,
and
it was
like,
the most
who
popular.
Who want to steal a Cutlass Supreme? Well, that was the car that was the highest-selling car for a number of years, and it creates basically a statistical bulge. You know, you got 10 cars in a parking lot, and if 8 of them are suddenly Cutlass Supremes, you're probably going to get a Cutlass Supreme when you steal it.
Well, but I had a Grand Prix, which was the same thing, only better looking. 85 Grand Prix was my first car.
Hey, let's get our guest on here now. Peter, come on board, please. And joining us right now is Professor Peter Hofbauer.
Nope, oh, okay.
From Eco Motors. And Peter, clip your microphone on there because we want everybody to be able to hear you on this.
Okay.
And we've asked you to come on. Oop, here, I'll do that for you. It's backwards there.
Uh-huh.
And just put it on. Whoops, now I've got it wrong. There we go. So you've brought this fascinating engine, and a number of our viewers will remember when Don Runkel was on the show. This goes back last year to talk all about Eco Motors. But let's get into a little bit of who you are and what you've done, just so the audience knows. But you spent 20 years at Volkswagen designing engines, right?
Yes, I've been 20 years with Volkswagen.
Head of engine development?
And the last 10 years, head of powertrain development worldwide, yeah.
And you're the one who first did the high-speed direct injection common rail diesel, is that right? Or you led for the groundwork of that?
Well, what I did was the first the Volkswagen diesel engine, and then this RV, or VR engine, so... And a lot of engines. I brought a lot of engines in production.
And so we come to this opposed piston, opposed cylinder engine design, which is, it's a boxer engine,
No, not.
No, it's not? It's oh, not. Okay. It's a flat engine.
It's a flat
pancake engine. But not a, truly not a boxer.
No.
Right.
In a boxer, the pistons go like this, and here the pistons go like this.
Uh-huh.
And this is the whole engine.
This is the whole engine. This is a block. It's not the whole engine.
Yeah, we'd have an induction system on an exhaust. Yeah.
I got it, but I mean, this is smaller than we're used to seeing.
But, so everybody can see this. Just so you know what we're looking at here, let me describe it for those who are listening on the podcast, too. This thing is maybe 2 feet long.
It's 650 millimeter wide. Yeah.
Okay, and it's maybe 8 inches tall.
It's 220 millimeter high. This was a request from one of the...
What does it weigh?
Well, this is a plastic version. This is a prototype.
No, not that one, but I mean, what does the actual engine weigh?
It weighs about 100 pounds, fully dressed.
That's with the turbocharger?
With fully dressed.
100 pounds, fully dressed, and you said this is about 90 horsepower,
yeah.
And it's about a half liter of displacement.
Yeah.
Folks, this is a breakthrough.
That's
Let
power,
me tell you,
that's
this is
power density.
This is power density.
Yeah, that's a key. Right? This was designed for power density first for military applications where power density counts. And since 2008, we started EcoMotors for commercial applications.
And the reason that we wanted to have somebody from EcoMotors back right now this week, because we already had Don Runkel on, and he told us all about this. But you got a lot of money from Bill Gates and Khosla Ventures, the venture capital firm. You got about $23.5 million this week?
Yeah. So this is a Series B. We had a Series A with Vinod Khosla alone. And now we have Bill Gates and Vinod Khosla, two prominent investors.
How did Bill Gates get involved? How did he become aware of this? Why did he put money in the company?
Well, Vinod invited him to Menlo Park, and he showed him.
Do you think if I invited him to the studio here, he'd give me at least $10 million? I mean, think about I'm asking that only semi-facetiously. How do you invite Bill Gates to come look at an engine?
Well, Vinod is a prominent guy, is not? So Bill Gates was interested in what he's doing, and he showed him his top investments. Vinod has about 60 companies, and he showed him five, and we have been one of them. And Bill Gates thinks this has future, this has power, this commercial gravity, so he invested in this.
So you need the money to continue development. The engine's
definitely
not fully developed yet?
No, this was planned. No? This is, as usual, a Series A investment, Series B investment. But after this, we will be very near to production. We will need another Series C to get to production.
Would that be an IPO, possibly?
No, not now. Okay. After that.
Okay.
After that.
So, wow. So who's interested in this? Can you talk about where this may end up running sometime soon?
We hope so. Yeah. We are very close to finalize a contract with a Chinese truck company. We published this. We said,
yeah.
We are working on a deal with a very prominent U.S. truck and engine company.
And the Chinese truck company would be interested in what kind of version of this engine?
Well, first of all, in both. We are focused at the moment on a 300 horsepower module truck engine, but we always promote two modules because.
So this is 90 horse, and you can scale it up to 300 horse for trucks.
No. This is a bigger. This has a 65 millimeter bore. The 300 horsepower module has a 100 millimeter bore, and this one meter wide. We are focused only just on this because we have to do one job right before we. But we will start now with this passenger car version, and they have in mind first to start as a truck engine, but perhaps also gensets. But they also want from us a later passenger car version.
And it can be diesel or auto cycle.
It can be diesel or gasoline.
In fact, look at the video, the animation that Carmen's got up on the screen. And it'll
Whoa.
Show you kind of how that operates.
Mm-hmm. Well,
so you can see there's two modules there, and they'll stop one. So stop-start engine, you literally stop half the engine.
So one module is four pistons, two cylinders.
Yeah, and the translator for cylinder inlet, right? So, and four stroke. Yeah? Mm-hmm. So you wouldn't hear the difference to four cylinder inlet, but it is 100% balanced.
I was going to ask, what about secondary and tertiary vibrations?
Totally balanced. Wow. Each module is 100% balanced. Therefore, we can shut off the second module with an electronically controlled clutch, as you see it here. Mm-hmm. And because usually 80% in the four-stroke engine, 80% of the inertia is in the flywheel and only 20% is in the crank train, we can easily start and stop it by just opening or closing the clutch.
Wow. So give us some of the numbers here. 90 horsepower turbocharged, what kind of fuel economy is it getting? I mean, tell us the advantages of this versus your plain old four-cylinder or V6 or V8 engine.
We claim... First, we can meet the emissions because it's a two-stroke, and the first question of everybody, two-stroke cannot meet emissions. We can meet emissions. Let me start with this.
And you're talking diesel or gasoline.
Diesel
doesn't
or
matter.
Doesn't matter. This depends on the gas exchange. And usually, a two-stroke engine has, after the intake ports or valves are closing, it has still 40 to 30% hot exhaust gas in it with radicals, and so therefore you cannot meet emissions. When we close the intake ports, we have 90% air in it and only 10% exhaust gas, and then we add cold, not reactive.
But cold EGR, right?
Cold EGR to handle the emissions. So this is an absolute important difference to a two-stroke engine. And though we have a very good gas exchange, and we have in addition an electronically or electric controlled turbocharger, which controls the boost and the back pressure. This was a development done in the original company in California. And with that, we can handle the gas exchange of a direct of a two-stroke engine. And this is a fundamental difference to a two-stroke engine. Now, to the emissions, this engine has only 50% of the friction of a conventional engine. There are a lot of reasons, because this outer piston, this long one, create only minor side forces on the skirt. Mm-hmm. And we are even catching these side forces with linear bearings, so we have no side forces on the outer.
Linear bearings in it?
Yeah, but because we can do it.
Because it's moving such a short distance, right?
Yeah, and there are no side forces.
Okay.
There are no side forces, so we can easily catch these little forces and take all the forces from the piston skirt. Mm-hmm. So we can have on the outer pistons an exact cylinder. We don't have barrel shape, we have no ovality, and so we can seal it with a stationary oil seal which controls the oil flow and the lubrication of the pistons. The inner piston is very conventional, but it still has a relative long rod compared to the stroke. Mm-hmm. Usually in a passenger car engine, the ratio of the length of the rod to the eccentricity of on the crankshaft should be between 3 and 3.4. So the rod should be three times longer than this eccentricity. My Volkswagen DTI engine had a ratio of 2.95, so it was more on the compact size, or a little more on the higher friction size. So, and as long as higher this number is, as lower the friction is. Mm-hmm. And because these rods are so long,
the friction goes
dramatically down. Then, all the forces are going to the crankshaft and not to the block. If we could run this again. The outer rods are pulling, the inner rods are pushing, and this cancels all the forces which would go usually to the main bearings.
Right, so and they're carried through the whole block.
But that's not the case here. We have almost no forces on the main bearings, and we need only two main bearings instead of five in the four-cylinder inline engine. Mm. And all this together, we can easily show the friction is half of a conventional engine. And there's a rule of thumb for the EPA test. 5% improvement in friction gives you 1% improvement in efficiency. So if you have 50% improvement, so you would get 10%. We are not claiming this. We claim 8 or 7. So this is one source of the improvement of the friction, just from the architecture. It's a two-stroke. It doesn't have the gas exchange, the low-pressure gas exchange loop from the exhaust and the intake stroke. This gives you another advantage of perhaps 3%. And in all opposed piston engines, the heat transfer to the coolant is much, much lower. It's about 30% lower to a conventional engine. And this gives you about another 2%. And so if you add up, you can claim this, and we have shown this, this engine has about 15% as one module, 15% improvement in fuel consumption. But if you have now a second module, and you can shut off the second one, this is not valve deactivation. Then you are getting rid of all the friction and all the bumping losses of the second module. You get about 30% additional improvement in fuel consumption. Of course, it costs a little more. But overall, we can claim we can get 50% with a two-module version, 50% improvement in fuel consumption.
50%? 50%. Wow. And if the cost?
If it's gasoline or diesel. Yeah, the production cost, including, well, we have very much simplified, or I have very much simplified, the mechanical part of this engine. But we need mechatronic units, like this electronic controlled turbocharger, mm-hmm. and this electronically controlled clutch, and other mechatronic parts.
Direct injection?
Of course. Yeah. Also, as gasoline, we would do only direct injecting turbocharged mm-hmm. engines. Diesel anyway is turbocharged. So the cost should be much, much less. But we got quotes from tier one suppliers. So we might end up with 20% lower production cost and about 30% lower investment for the production.
Are there any challenges to getting this into a car? Noise, you know anything that the automakers may tell you, go back and work on this and we'll consider it, or is this just ready to go? You just need the money and time to get it ready.
No, we don't need the money now. we need and we will get this. We need joint developments with car companies. We cannot do this alone. There is no doubt about it. So we are looking for joint developments. And we will see if this is in the States or in
Paris. This is why I find this company so interesting. Here you have Peter Hofbauer, known entity. This guy's done engines. There's millions of them out on the road today. There's no question about it. They've got Don Runkel, you know, who's got all the background of his time. You used to work for him at General Motors.
Yeah, he was my boss.
Right.
Yep, absolutely.
And then at Delphi. And John Coletti, who ran SVT at Ford. With an engine that can boost fuel economy 50%, that is, what'd you say, 30% lower manufacturing cost? No, 30% less investment cost.
20%
and 20% lower manufacturing cost. And all I'm saying is, if you guys put this in a car and achieve what you're talking about, kiss the whole battery thing, kiss the whole fuel cell thing.
One of the problems it has is it's new.
Yeah, of course.
And how much of not invented here thing is?
No, I'm not even addressing not invented here. The fact is, this is something that they aren't familiar with.
Yeah, let me, if I would still be with Volkswagen as head of powertrain.
Somebody brought this to you.
Yeah, I might not take it because I would tell him what I'm hearing from the former Big Three. I have a program. We have a program for the next 8 years. We have fought it very hard to get this approved from the board, and now I have this program. Please don't disturb me. This is more important than not invented here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Disruptions in these businesses are devastating because you're affecting what they think normalcy is.
Well, you know, they've all poured billions of dollars. All the major manufacturers poured billions of dollars into what they've got or what they're just about to come out with. So when you come out and go, voila, here's the solution, it's like, well, let's see if we can fit this into our cycle plan. We might bring it out in 2020.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah, that's
the issue.
Yeah. And that's different in Far East.
That's
different in China. That's different in India.
Well, it's different in China and India because they have not made that massive investment.
They have different baselines.
And they have to invest anyway in new engines. And they can make this jump to do a new technology.
It's inertia. In other words. It's inertia.
Yeah.
I know you're saying because I know engineers in GM who for years were trying to get GM to look at using more hydroforming and more space frame technology to replace stampings, but everybody in the company was used to bending metal to make frames, and they just couldn't get people to stop engineering cars and platforms with bent metal frames and welding.
It's the whole concept of the comfort zone and doing what you used to.
You know the guys I'm talking about.
Yes, I do.
But here's the thing, too. Let me just add. They're going to say, yeah, we could do all this lost foam and we could do all this molding and all that. But we just spent $4 billion right. on all new press lines.
Yeah, of course.
We got to get our return out of that.
If you are in a company, you have a lot of boundary conditions which you cannot see from the outside.
Right. Right.
And you have a lot, in addition, you have a lot of fights, but mainly you have boundary conditions, which you have to accept. When I brought the first Volkswagen diesel engine, I had to put it on a gasoline transfer line. I did it. the first time in the history. But I had to use this gasoline transfer line. For example, I had to put the injector exactly at the same axis where the spark plug was. This was an absolute... necessity. Mm. Otherwise, we couldn't have done it. So from outside looking, this guy is doing a great job because they have to handle all these boundary conditions, which we don't see from outside.
Mm. But isn't there a program that they could just say, okay, let's start it off on this program that's, you know, small by their standards, but still pretty good volume, but doesn't upset the whole flow of what they're doing?
Yeah, we hope we will get such programs. We are not there. At the moment, we have a truck engine. Hmm. We have a truck engine running. I couldn't bring this with me. It's a 300 horsepower unit. But that's running on the dyno. And this, of course, is not in the focus of
But what fuel economy would that 300 horsepower unit get in a truck, a pickup truck, say?
Yeah, it's the same 15% and 50%. You can get this, yeah.
Just pickups. Big, heavy Class 7 and 8 trucks.
Yeah, but do you need 600 horsepower diesel in that?
So you're looking at...
It's a medium to heavy engine, basically.
It would fit nicely.
So you're looking at getting like 27 or so mpg for half ton.
Then you have a one module, but then you get only this 15% improvement.
Yeah.
It wouldn't fit very nice in my Porsches.
I want to show something else here, too, because this is so cool. And I know only the people watching right now, not on the podcast, will see this. But we have what looks like kind of a...
It's a Denon DVD player, isn't it?
Yeah. It looks like a briefcase, really. Mm-hmm. Kind of a black
like old
briefcase.
It's a typewriter briefcase.
It's got but a little bit bigger. And then when you slip this cover off... I don't want to scratch up your beautiful display. And let's get this on the camera, Seamus, because inside
Good Lord.
Is another miniature version of the engine.
This is a 30-millimeter bore.
And what I find amazing about this, anybody who knows anything about buying electric generators, you know, in case the electricity goes out in your house or whatever, this is 5 kilowatts in a suitcase. Now, 5 kilowatts, just to put that in a little bit in perspective... I added it all up on my house. If I ran everything, the air conditioning and the furnace and the stove and, you know, the TV and everything.
Lights, refrigerator.
Everything, turned on everything in the house, it would use about 8 kilowatts. So this little suitcase could run my entire house just about if I powered down a few things.
So it's 5 kilowatts, but it would be 5 kilowatts. We are not working on this.
This is not active?
No, we are fully focused on the truck engine.
But let's explain. You started this for the military, and yes. Then you guys went, let's concentrate on getting something in cars first. Yeah,
so have you violated some Federal Secrets Act by taking the lid off on the Internet?
No.
But you could sell this as a portable power unit for homes.
Sure,
and probably
but
sell...
But it has to be developed. That costs money, and this costs... we need an engineering team for an additional, and we are fully focused on this truck engine. So we don't want to do several things at the same time.
But this is something, if that gets moved off top dead center, then this could be a future development?
This is on the shelf. Yeah. This will come. This is a huge market.
Oh, yeah.
This is for APUs in cars. Mm-hmm. All luxury cars need additional electricity. And every truck needs this in the future because you are not allowed to run your big engine overnight.
Keep it warm.
Every truck will need this.
Wow. And what about fuel for this? Could this be run on natural gas if it were for a portable generator thing?
We developed this for GP8, which is something like diesel. Mm-hmm. But, of course... Gasoline is always easier than diesel.
Wow.
But I just had to show this because I'm just blown away about the amount of power that you can get out of something that small.
Brief.
Yeah. And the other thing, too,
how much power does this thing put out?
5 kilowatt electric.
You said?
5 kilowatt electric. The secret is the speed. This engine, because the pistons have to move only half the distance, then the can run double the speed. Which means this is the first factor of two in power density.
Mm-hmm.
Right? If you have double the speed, you have double the expansion stroke, you get double the power. If the two-stroke or direct gas exchange gives you another 1.8...
That's on top of that.
Then you get the power density. You, of course, you have to run this generator very fast. There's a planetary gear set in it which speeds it up to...
Oh, that's a planetary generator?
This is a generator and there's a planetary gear set between, which speeds it up to get the power out of it. Originally, and I would say, if this goes to production with 5 kilowatt, after 3 years, that thing has 10 kilowatt. This is always the same. My first, Volkswagen diesel engine had 50 horsepower. Everybody was happy. Now, from the same iron, they make 150 horsepower. Emission control, extreme good fuel consumption. If a product is in production, of course, it improves automatically.
You know, one thing that strikes me here is I look at the diagram that we had online there of the engine. This is technology that seemingly somebody should have stumbled on already. I mean, that it was possible to...
Why didn't you think of this a long time ago, Peter?
It was possible to do this some time ago.
It's always the reaction.
Was there some breakthrough that...
From heads of powertrain here in the town, the first is wow. And then why haven't I done this?
Where did you get the idea?
But what's this doing?
Well, the idea is a result of 40-year engine development.
But was there some breakthrough in terms of materials or something like that enabled you to do it now? Or
anything. This is fully built on automotive technology and what suppliers can supply it. This has a crankshaft. This has connecting rods. This
available lubricants and so on. It doesn't need miracle oil.
We work only with tier one suppliers. They have no problems to deliver us the prototype part.
Any good machine shop could build this. Just about.
Yeah, but I wouldn't go to a machine.
Well, I know. But all I'm saying is there's no exotic materials. There's no exotic manufacturing.
Yeah.
This is really good.
Yeah, but of course, the boxer engine is the starting point. Right?
Well,
you have always, with boxer engines, you have always a problem to fix the cylinder head on this very fragile crankcase. Because you know in the boxer you need a hole underneath the bearing to have the gas exchange between these chambers. This makes it very, very fragile. And... the idea is replace the cylinder head with another piston and get all the power out of it. That's all.
The whole idea of, because to me, when I look at this, a moron's view is you have an articulated cylinder head in a regular engine, but you're just moving, instead of having to move the piston as far, you're moving the head down to it in a way.
That's a basic idea.
What a great idea. But I can understand why it didn't happen, why somebody didn't think of it earlier. A lot of this is geometry. When you think of an engine historically, the development of the reciprocating piston engine has been a single moving piston in a fixed container. I mean, at one time, the heads were integral with the blocks.
Yeah, and the cylinder head was a given. Valves have been a given. They work very nicely. Why should we change it?
Wow. Remember, so much of technological development is comfort of individuals when something becomes a standard.
Sure.
There's always a hesitancy to violate the standard too much.
Yeah.
And you do it at your own risk. Because I'm sure, companies do advanced powertrain development with things that never pan out.
Yeah, but all the car companies are fully occupied to handle the emissions.
Mm-hmm.
All their capacity goes in this direction. Nobody dares to think about another architecture.
Oh,
So and therefore nobody is doing that thing. Everybody has to make sure that next year you can sell the cars. You get it through EPA.
And how do we invent anything?
The thing is, if you think about it, things like hybrids and things like the Volt drivetrain and Nissan doing a pure electric is reacting to the emissions issue.
Yeah.
It's a direct reaction, because if you were to look at the amount of money a global car company spends on emissions certification, development, and validation in a year for the world, it's an eye-watering amount of money. And anything you could do to disconnect from that, you would try to pursue.
And you get no support in big companies to do such things, which is out of the box and doesn't help to meet the emissions.
How did you get the VR6 passed? Because the VR6, in a lot of ways, I've always equated it to an old Lancia V4 done right.
Yeah, I didn't even know that.
You didn't know about the Lancia V4?
No, I didn't know. I rented it without it. But I learned, of course, later. Well, no, this was a task. Put a six-cylinder east-west in the Golf.
Mm-hmm.
That was it.
So, well, the only way you were going to do it is, yeah. But was any, the VR6 effectively used one cylinder head.
Yeah.
So there was a cost reduction in a way, too, as far as from materials casting components count.
No, yeah, good. If it would be in the same mass production as a four-cylinder, yes.
Yeah,
but
okay.
It's not, of course. And scale effect, of course, counts.
So,
but yeah, it has only one cylinder head. My first version had only one camshaft.
It was a single cam, two valve, yeah. I remember.
So and then we made two camshafts with four valves, and yeah. Yeah, but you see, it has a renaissance now. It's now in the new CC, the Passat. It's in again.
Yep.
Before I had my Porsche, I had this R32
The Golf with the nice car.
This was as fast as my Porsche.
I had an R32. I had an R32 TT for a while, and it's an amazing engine.
Yeah.
Hey, we ought to move to the next part of the show because I know we've got some viewer questions. And Carmen, let's bring in the rapid fire animation.
We should replace Jason's face in there with Jim's.
So, Peter, we call this rapid fire, and we go through questions that the audience is submitting to us, and we try to give fast answers so we can get through everything. So,
we don't always do that.
We don't always do that, but that's the plan. So Brad writes in to say, I can see this engine having potential in aviation. Is anything like that planned?
From there it comes. The first application was in the A160 helicopter for Boeing. Fortunately, from business view, this whole helicopter died.
Uh-huh.
And because we would have to deliver 200 engines and would have problems to the end of our life if someone, it was a drone, and if this drone falls down, it should fly 35,000 feet.
For helicopter?
40 hours.
Home.
And therefore, they couldn't use a gas turbine because
consumption is too high.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So this was the first. And we just showed EADS just showed this in the air show in Berlin. I've been there in their helicopter, and it was also shown in Houston at the helicopter show from EADS. So there is a lot of interest. And after the Berlin show, Boeing called. So it's, sure.
So the answer is yes.
Yes.
Aviation is in the picture.
Definitely yes. But we are not so sure, is it a business?
Yeah. Okay. Fields Ferrier says, and you guys who are better technically than I am might be able to answer this. What about ETOH in an eco motor? Is ETOH, what's that?
I should know
electric.
This.
ETOH? I don't know.
I'm thinking of NMOGs.
Wasn't that the judge in the O.J. Simpson case?
I think it was. Yeah, it was.
I don't know.
Okay.
You know, these TLAs.
Fields, you stomped us.
These TLAs and FLAs are dangerous.
TLA?
Three-letter acronyms and four-letter acronyms.
Okay.
You can't run modern business without them, though, I've been told.
There's an MBA class on that.
Sean Childress says, I've been researching the technology of using algae for fuel and recently ran across a company that claims to derive ethanol from algae without destroying the structure of the strain. Just wondering if you guys heard any news regarding this.
Okay, again, the Berlin Air Show, the EADS showed, had an algae farm there and produced fuel for this engine.
Yeah, I've heard about algae-based ethanol. I didn't know that it didn't destroy the strain, but it makes more sense logically because you're not trying to turn it into really an effectively larger molecule, so you can basically extract some of the...
You have just to clean it and refine it. So. As biodiesel, you also cannot use biodiesel as you get it from the plant. You have to refine it.
Mm-hmm. Because, you know, a lot of the stuff you get from... algae is, there's a lot of waste product in there.
Sure.
And that's one of the secrets to why it's fuel.
We got another question here. We're going to move this.
Okay.
Artemis 77 says, on the Eco Motors engine, how does the electric spark system work?
I don't want to answer that.
Oh, proprietary
good
technology.
Good question, Artemis.
It's a very good question. It's a very good question. But there are two solutions.
And you're not going to tell us either one, right?
This is a too good question.
Is it a sparkless engine like the higher compression diesels? No,
you have to get the, you want in the gasoline or the auto engine, you want to have the spark in the middle of the combustion chamber. No?
Yeah.
So now we have to get it somewhere in the middle of the combustion chamber.
Wow.
So,
and I think they've done that, but I don't think we're going to see how.
We have little engines running which has this, but there are. I can say this: there are new ignition systems coming from Ecos in Florida, now bought by Bero, or by Borgwana and moved to Bero, and they have a high performance. Spark, which would shoot through the whole combustion.
It shoots across the chamber. Yeah, right. That's the one that's the ring combustor, the ring igniter.
Yeah, it's a plasma. Blah blah blah.
I think we're getting hints of where this thing's gone. okay, we got a correction in here. Fields Ferrier wants to know, what about using ethanol in your eco motor?
No problem. We ran little engines with ethanol. We convinced Vinod Kosler by showing him this little one running on ethanol.
There you go.
What about using French fry grease? French fry grease, like some of the cars.
Diesel substitute is what you mean.
Well, it's not available. So in reality.
I know. I'm kidding.
Is the engine compression sensitive as far as the grade of fuel you use in it? So if you're using gasoline, for example.
This is exactly the same. This engine behaves exactly as a conventional.
As far as sensitivity, if you have it set for high compression, you'd have to use a higher octane fuel.
You have to trim the combustion, the compression ratio. But if the friction is so low, mm-hmm. then you can have a higher compression ratio and can increase the efficiency. Because usually, in a diesel engine, the compression ratio is at the optimum of 1 to 15, let's say. And the reason is, if you go higher, then what you are winning thermodynamic is less than what the friction is going up.
Oh, okay.
And if the friction is very low, then you can get a little more of the thermodynamic
and you're gonna get,
effect of compression ratio.
So you'll get far more better combustion when you ignite the diesel that way.
Not
yeah.
far more.
Well, but appreciably, but measurably better.
But we are fighting for each percent.
Okay.
Hey, we've got a phone call here, Carmen. Let's bring in the phone call. Let's bring in Jonathan Brown. Can you get to that one?
Hi, this is Jonathan Brown out in Olds Pan, New Jersey. And I have a quick question. To me, it seems like this Eco Motors would be the perfect power plant for a generator for a vehicle like the Chevy Volt. Mm-hmm. Smaller in size, small, easy packaging, high power, high torque, low emissions. Sounds like it would be a great addition
to replace
the 1.4-liter motor they're presently using. Anyways, that's my question. Would it be a good power plant for a generator of a vehicle like the Bolt?
Definitely. Definitely.
Thank you very much.
It's
great
a very good question, and your assumption
right.
is absolutely
perfect.
Right.
It's smaller, it's lightweight.
This brings up a question.
Because in this plug-in or in normal hybrids, what you want even let the combustion engine disappear. You don't want the combustion
right.
engine. So you want a very small, light, cost-effective engine. And this might be a little smaller for a plug-in, but it might be already the right size for a hybrid.
But a question about that. This engine would run at a single speed, wouldn't it?
No.
No?
No.
You wouldn't run the generator at a constant speed?
Well, it depends. It depends on the application. Mm-hmm. Normal gensets are running at one speed and up and down the load.
Right. Would you do that with this?
Yeah, but this was not designed for this. This has an electronic system which can run it in the whole map.
But the thing is, with a vehicle like the Volt, where the engine is being used exclusively to charge the battery, wouldn't it be best to run the engine at one speed?
Well, yeah. You have to pick the right displacement.
Of course.
Where you get the minimum of fuel consumption. You have to run the engine. It's a sweet point.
Right, of course.
And you have to find the right displacement, and looks like this.
Okay, Ford guy wants to know, what's the, not just the horsepower, we mentioned the horsepower in this one, yeah. This is 90 horsepower. What about the torque?
Well, I can give you the measured, or the real numbers of our truck engine.
Okay.
The one module is 800 Newton meter, and the power is 300 horsepower.
That's running on diesel, right?
That's running on diesel.
Okay.
So 800 Newton meters is how much in foot-pounds?
I don't know.
God. 400?
No. It's in the high fives.
Oh.
Yeah, it's high fives, maybe even low sixes. Yeah.
So
yeah.
You have great torque output as well.
Again, if I...
That's tree climbing torque with the right tires.
Yeah, the problem is the transmission. Especially in the Porsche, I would crack the transmission immediately.
Okay, here's a question off Eco Motors for a minute. Elmer Bringus says, a brief question about gas and brake pedal spacing. This gets back to the Toyota unintended acceleration. He asks, is there a best practice or an industry standard in terms of pedal spacing? He says, I drive a 2010 Matrix, and while turning left, crossing opposing traffic, I stepped on both the brake and gas at the same time. I nearly missed getting T-boned.
John, I was involved. This is Audi.
Oh, were you really?
Because they had an engine in those cars.
It was the Volkswagen automatic transmission. And the reason was what you guessed here already. In an Audi, you have, this is the only car which has a north-south installation and a front-wheel drive.
So the pedal box is tight.
That means you have the wheel in the passenger compartment, and the area for the pedals is smaller. And the real reason was the people mixed up the gas pedal with the and we could prove this later.
Mm-hmm.
And what was claimed in this 60-minute story, this was all not.
It was garbage.
It was garbage. But this was the reason. And then we invented. That you have to push to teach the driver where is the gas pedal and where is the brake pedal. You have to push the brake pedal when you shift, just to teach him this is the brake pedal.
And became a regulation.
And it became a regulation.
Just as I believe the brake override system is probably going to become regulated.
It should be. That's a no-brainer, and it's not almost a no-cost thing.
Yeah. The thing is, there's no standard. There's no government standard for pedal position. There really isn't, at least none in the United States, and I don't think the EU has one either.
No.
But they have driver education in the EU, and apparently we don't here. So there's no standard best practices. I'm sure for certain types of cars, you could find something that's optimum for that buyer. But
yeah, we studied after this Audi disaster. We studied crazy pedals, which are overlapping, and we did a lot of which have flappers, and this all doesn't really work. The best solution was to teach the driver where is the brake pedal.
But then they forget.
And they turn into old doddering boomers, you know. I mean, I can say that.
Ford guy also wrote in to say, Toyota says the black box is not perfect. That's right. And they do not attribute all unintended acceleration to driver error. That's right. We know that there's the pedal entrapment with the floor mats and the sticky pedals.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're just driving in a parking lot and it takes off on you, it's not the sticky pedal. It's not the floor
mat. It's not cosmic rays. Yeah. Remember that?
Right. Yeah. Salvador G. wants to know, Peter, when do you think we can see a test car driving the Eco Motors engine?
Yeah, and next year.
Next year. I can't
end
wait.
Next year.
Okay.
Perhaps very end. we always said in Volkswagen in fall, in autumn, because this ends in the 21st of December.
So you're fine.
we'll just get to two more here, and then we'll call it up. But Vic Esposito wants to know, he's been on your Eco Motors website, and he has two questions. Can you explain your glider automatic?
The glider automatic was in production in Volkswagen. This worked at that time only with diesels. Every time when the driver didn't touch the gas pedal, the engine stopped. And you was gliding. And therefore, I'm very confident that we can handle this electronic clutch between these two engines, because in this car, I had to handle to restart the engine with the inertia of the car and with the starter motor. And it worked perfectly. It worked. We tested it in San Francisco on the steep streets, and it worked as good as an automatic transmission. So this was a system which always stopped the engine.
So the engine was shut off.
When the driver didn't touch the gas pedal.
Wow.
And it worked. And you would be amazed how far a car runs just with its inertia.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't brake it with your engine or via your automatic transmission.
Now, did some drivers find this disconcerting? Because a lot of people are used to backing off the gas and the car will slow. Here, it would sort of just, it'd be like putting the car, an automatic, into neutral, would it not?
Yes, you're absolutely right. We gave 10 cars to the mail department in Hanover, and the drivers didn't like it because when they stopped at the intersection, the people showed them they are crazy because they killed the engine. Huh? And there have been other reasons which makes them very nervous. So they always used the master switch to
turn it back on,
not to stop it. So there is, especially people get nervous when you are gliding, let's say, with 120 kilometers and hear no engine noise.
Mm-hmm.
So we invented there what we call the heartbeat, a synthetic noise, which told you the engine is still alert. But this is a problem.
How did you manage brake boost and steering? Or were these cars didn't have power steering?
This was automatically controlled. If this was low, then the engine didn't shut off.
Okay.
Also, but downhill, for example.
Very interesting. Okay, we'll take this as the last question. It's from Stephen Dargell, or Dargle, I'm not sure. I hope I didn't say that too wrong there. He says, the number one problem with the EcoMotor OPEC engine is the package size. 42 inches wide will not work in current vehicles. What's your solution
to
the packaging?
Well, 42 inches wide is a truck engine. This you can install east, west, north, south. We had, you can make two engines and the transmission in the middle. And we have designed this in the North American passenger car.
So that will fit in any even a compact.
So the distance between these two beams for the crash test is always between 850 and 900 millimeter. This is only 650 millimeter, right? So it easily fits in.
But if you were to mount it transversely, then you'd have a length problem, potentially, if you started stacking modules, right? You'd be limited in how many modules you could do in a transverse application?
Yeah. Well, we did the study. We think east-west is anyway good because you save 3% because you don't have to...
You don't have to turn the gear 90 degrees.
So therefore, we did only a study. But I'm pretty sure we can also put it the other way around. But usually you have a front-wheel drive, and then you might... Yeah, you might get to.
Well, statistically, the majority of cars built in this country are transverse.
Yeah, and I don't know if it's on your website, but I know when Don Runkle was here, he had like a drawing of how this engine would package. And to your question, exactly, David, mm-hmm. it would package in any compact, subcompact car, no problem.
And it would have the advantage for the crash test that because it's so flat, you can easily let it glide under the passenger compartment. Mm-hmm.
And the center of gravity is going to be low on it also, the
this
dynamic
is for
center of gravity.
Class, very
What's for everything?
This thing is good for aircraft, race cars, and military, but also for normal passenger cars.
And APUs, power generating units.
Yeah.
Well, real good.
That's a moneymaker right there.
I know.
I think we ought to wrap it up. We've gone a little bit longer than we normally do. But Peter Hofbauer, thanks so much for coming in and talking about this engine. Very, very interesting. And Jim Hall, thank you for flying in just for the show.
Yeah, just for the show.
Racing up from the airport. And David Welch, always great having you here,
always
as always.
Always good to be here, John.
And remember, folks, you can always follow everything that we do on our Facebook page at Out of Line Detroit. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/outofline. For Peter DeLorenzo stuff, Peter's not here with us tonight, but make sure you go to his website, autoextremist.com. Read David Welch's stuff at bloomberg.com and businessweek.com. In fact, you just had a story that broke tonight. What was that on?
I didn't have one tonight. I had one yesterday.
Which was which one?
On part of GM's RFP for the For the IPO.
For the IPO. Okay, I only saw the story today. I thought it came out today.
They asked the investment banks if they would buy a bunch of GM cars with some of the fees for the IPO to try to get Wall Street.
They're selling. They're selling every which way, huh?
But think about it. Look, some of the new Buicks are great, but you're a big money Wall Street guy who lives on Long Island or in the Hamptons or something, and your company gives you a Buick. It's like winning a Buick in a raffle. You drive an S-Class.
or the truth is, those guys will probably end up getting, like, CTSVs anyway, if their company's smart. You're not going to give a guy a...
I know, but I'd done a story a while back for our blog,
Lucerne,
actually.
Maybe.
Yeah. I'd done a story on our blog a while back how GM was considering opening this salon. You and I talked about this, right, in New York, sort of like the Audi experience. And they would have all four brands there to try to get New Yorkers, you know, the fashion crowd, the Wall Street crowd, to look at GM cars. And I pulled the numbers. And GM's market share in the New York metro area is below 10%. It's like 9.4% or something.
Wow.
Versus like 19% in the rest of the country. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they're trying to get into that crowd. It's really tough for them. But it's a very unusual thing to put in the RFP for your public stock offering.
So, and people can find that at Bloomberg.com.
Right. There's probably a version of it on the Business Week website by now as well. But I'd go to Bloomberg to look for it.
And Peter, your website, ecomotors.com?
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
Okay. Very good. Okay. Well, and remember, folks, you can get all our stuff on Stitcher. Just go to our website, follow the icon to the Stitcher logo, and you can find out how to get all our programs on your phone. And check out Open Line on Monday. And again, check out our website on to how to get that. And thanks, everybody. And we can run the closing credits.
Visit our website, outofline.detroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily automotive news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline Detroit. That's all there and much more at AutolineDetroit.tv.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence.